Side 2 of tape number 378, March the 2nd. It's Mae Brussel in Carmel, California, and we'll continue on the Rockefeller murder and an update of the news. I want to make a correction on side 1 of the tape. I said that Ponchetta Pierce came from the University of California. I meant to say the University of Southern California, because that makes a great big difference. I also had mentioned on other tapes that I believed that blackmail could be used with the ambassadors, and I referred to the Tony Laskowitz operation, the man that worked for Richard Nixon, who had cameras available to photograph the women that had been at Chappaquiddick and other agents through walls to use sex as a blackmail, and wondered if Laskowitz was tied up to the Rockefeller scene. There was an allegation at the time of the Watergate stories that Tony Laskowitz was on a ferry boat in Michigan with Arthur Bremer before Bremer took a shot at Wallace at the time of the 1972 elections. It always stayed in a rumor category, but it could have been pursued much, much farther. Mary Jo Kopechne's body was pulled out of a car up at Chappaquiddick in the water there, and Tony Laskowitz was up at Chappaquiddick immediately. He was posed as a newspaper man, and he worked for Richard Nixon and E. Howard Hunt and G. Gordon Liddy and the White House plumbers to frame and embarrass Ted Kennedy. And he was described in the book The Nightmare Decade as being the person asking embarrassing questions at the news conference and reporting them back by telephone and trying to get everything dirty he could dig up on Ted Kennedy at Chappaquiddick. Well, Tony Laskowitz didn't work in a vacuum. He worked with a lot of other people, and many of them that hired him and worked with him all went to the University of Southern California and were all there around the time that Ponchetta Pierce was there. One of those was Donald Segretti, who I'm quoting from Nightmare Decade, this particular book by Mr. Lucas about the White House plumbers, described Segretti as a man who didn't have much money, whose background was fairly simple. But in late 71, he was sporting a $6,000 white Mercedes sports car, which the CIA gave him. And he worked for a Los Angeles law firm as a cover, but that was actually a cover for the CIA, and that he was dating and having open houses and California parties and a lot of women. And he graduated from USC in 1963. Ponchetta Pierce was at the University of Southern California cum laude in 64, but they were all there at the same time. And then he went on to Bold Hall at Berkeley, and then to work for the Treasury Department in counterintelligence. The motive, Segretti said, he was the son of a hotel bellhop, and he was determined to make a splashy career for himself. And as soon as he got out of college, he met with his USC friends that were there with him when he went to school, Dwight Chapin and Gordon Strom of the Dirty Tricks Department, the blackmail, the sex blackmail department, the team of Richard Nixon's. Now, keep in mind that the Howard Hughes Summa people and Ronald Reagan people that put in Nixon are anti-Rockefeller, and this team was pulling these tricks and going to school. They were pulling these and going to school at University of Southern California as a body. They congregated there and then went on to the White House, and Ponchetta Pierce was at the campus at the same time and then goes on to work for Reader's Digest, which we'll get to in a minute. Another advertising man just out of USC, Harry Robbins Haldeman, followed Nixon's career since the days of Alger Hiss as a USC student. Newspaper was purged of so-called red influence. He worked his way up and then got into politics on the campus at USC and then worked for J. Walter Thompson, the same public relations firm that's tied into Mullen and Company in Washington, D.C., that was involved with Watergate, and also Thompson is the public relations firm that represents or did the San Francisco Police Department, He worked with the accounts of 7-Up, Walt Disney, Black Flag, and so forth. Another man, Herbert Porter, who reported G. Gordon Liddy, was a team member who went to University of California with Dwight Chapin, Gordon Strong, Ron Ziegler, and Segretti. And he originally, in 1970, he went from USC to a small computer company in Phoenix. And in 1964, when Poinsettia Pierce left USC, cum laude, she goes back east, works with Ebony and CBS and NBC. And in 1968, she's working with Nelson Rockefeller, on the staff with Nelson Rockefeller, and Herb Porter is already, Herbert Porter is distributed to Phoenix. And one day he gets a call from a USC friend in Washington and tells him to arrange Nixon's trip, and Herbert Porter is part of the Nixon team. And they could count on him, as I say. Ron Ziegler came from Kentucky, moved to California. He transferred to the USC campus. He was a B marketing major and active in the Young Republicans. And when Nixon came to USC in 1960, he was campaigning against John Kennedy at the time. This Ron Ziegler helped him with that campaign, and then was hired by Bob Haldeman to go to J. Walter Thompson and also work for that account. So that the USC campus was literally buzzing with counterintelligence agents that were displaced to other people. They were there around the same period that Poinsettia Pierce was, and then she goes on to work for Ebony Magazine and then goes to work for the Reader's Digest also. And there are these two missing years, 1971 to 73, that might explain where she might have possibly gotten some intelligence training and activity. The Howard Hughes name comes up in all of my research because, for those of you who don't know the past work that I've done on Hughes, is my belief that the Hughes organization has been the cover for the CIA and for the assassination teams through the years. It's the umbrella that can't be touched because of its defense contracts. There's a show on TV this week, February 27th, 1978, the 2020 show by Hidalgo Rivera on Howard Hughes. And it has to do with that lawsuit, the seclusion of Hughes and the drugging of Hughes that I mentioned last week on the tape. But it showed Bill Gay, the mastermind behind the Hughes organization, the faceless man who's rarely photographed and will give no comments to the press, who was originally just a chauffeur and driver for Howard Hughes. And Bill Gay is the, or was until he was kicked out and now he's being sued for $50 million, along with the others, was the faceless power behind this huge operation. But it showed him in a car leaving his Encino, California home. Now, Megan Marshak lives in Encino, California. Her family came from there, and her father was angry at Richard Nixon for dropping the aerospace contracts. Her boyfriend, fiancé, that did photographic work at Nelson Rockefeller's home and also down his estate in Venezuela, David Lustig, came from Encino, California, and Poinsettia Pierce came from the University of Southern California that was working with Richard Nixon. And I think if you pursue the Paul Lexalt management, Senator Paul Lexalt management of the Ronald Reagan Fund drive, you would find in this whole can of worms the same network that's been pulling this chicanery for years of bullets and blackmail during the time of elections or preceding them. Howard Hughes was the major contributor to Richard Nixon's career starting from his very early days, and the Howard Hughes that we know, or the person that wasn't seen since 1957, had selected on paper Paul Lexalt as the next president, but Lexalt is managing Reagan's campaign. But that scene of Bill Gay and Encino reminded me of Marshak and Lustig, David Lustig, and then Poinsettia Pierce down at USC, is an important area to investigate in terms of the espionage in the Rockefeller demise. Not that I think Rockefeller is perfect. I think he was terrible, and we can do a whole show on his combination of Sterling Drug and I.G. Farben and Nazi connections. But the point is that even as bad as he is, his power is now neutralized, and another team holds the atomic bombs or doomsday bombs in their little fingers. Now, there's an important article in the New York Times, I don't know if you saw it, if you didn't go to the library and get it, February the 24th, 1979, on how Richard Nixon tried to mold the TV, the public broadcasting, and how he turned it into something that would shape the future, which is exactly what I know our KQED does now. And it tells how Richard Nixon stopped the newscast of Sandy Van Oger and Robert McNeil, and how he called in the large corporations and told them to put on cultural shows and eliminate the political, that there shouldn't be politics funding for public broadcasting if you do politics. And this is why we get Exxon and Mobil and Ford Foundation putting on our ballet and nothing serious really coming over there. One of the first serious shows I saw last week was on Paul Jacobs. But the man who was writing the memos for Richard Nixon, a Mr. Whitehead, who was writing the memos on cutting off federal funds to national educational television, neutralizing it from any political effect, or 200 non-commercial FM radio stations. The man whose name is signed to these, a Mr. Whitehead, whose name is mentioned in these memos of Richard Nixon's, Mr. Whitehead left the broadcasting department of Richard Nixon to work, where would you guess he's working, for the Howard Hughes Satellites Company right now. He was reached by phone as president of the Hughes Satellite Corporations. Now, maybe you don't remember, I mentioned briefly on a tape a while back the Howard Hughes Medical Institute forming now in Boston, Los Angeles, with 12 satellite communications. I believe they will outdo Auschwitz any day, and they'll be connected by satellite communication where the government should have been out of the medical business, because the Hughes organization is nothing but a CIA operation. And look what happened to that body they cashed in, if you see how they took care of that, the one that was supposed to be used. But the point is that Mr. Whitehead, the same man that was working to stop public broadcasting of 280 non-commercial television stations and 200 non-commercial FM radio stations, he's now in charge of the Hughes Satellite Corporation. And what they did was they attempted, it says, to kill the news sources and shape the future of public broadcasting. They had two goals: kill public broadcasting and the way it's going, or shape its future. And they decided to shape its future would be easier. So they reached to the foundations to support all the cultural material. And that's why you get Bill Moyer of the CIA on public broadcasting, giving his talk shows, and Marilyn Baker covering the lies about the SLA when it was really the CIA, or people like Burke Marshall and Ramsey Clark being on the board of directors of the Vera Foundation, which is Pacifica Radio, FM radio. While it's listener-sponsored, they're on the board of directors and can push Dialogue Conspiracy or Mae Brussel off the air when she gets too close to the truth. Now, what Nixon's committee did, and Mr. Whitehead, who's now in charge of Hughes Satellite Communication, was to shape the whole tone of public broadcasting so that today they can't run without the corporations, and the corporations will give you the Metropolitan Opera and Upstairs, Downstairs, and stories of the King of England and Edward and Victoria and all the little, the social plots that don't shake anybody's booties and keep everybody happy that they're getting culture in America. Another thing that Richard Nixon did, that he had his administration had a board which goal was to control the corporations, and it was working at the time he resigned in 1974, that they'd have a station program cooperative and stations would vote for national programs. And he set up an organization that would help him to stop this creeping networkism, he called it, in public broadcasting, which is the bedrock of localism, that they'd set up a board that would determine at a national level. And there were four people that he appointed to the board, four close ties to Richard Nixon's political control of public broadcasting. And the first on the list was Albert Cole, director of the Reader's Digest, the same person that Poinchetta Pierce worked for, the Reader's Digest, and that Mr. Albert Cole was director of the Reader's Digest. And then that was Nixon's first appointee to the board. Then Jack Rather and Thomas Moore and Thomas B. Curtis, former Republican congressman from Missouri. Now take that Reader's Digest connection one step further, because we're going to an important thing which is affecting all of our lives today, which is the control of public broadcasting, where we wanted to get our own kind of stories and news stories, the control of FM stations. The man who wanted to control them is now in charge of the used satellites, and the first man appointed to screen programs of what could be of a national order on public broadcasting was Al Cole of Reader's Digest, whom Pochetta Pierce worked for, the woman who didn't care whether Rocky was alive or dead, but who was assigned to Rockefeller in 1968 up until the day she was working on a commission of his in 68 when Richard Nixon became the president. Some of you remember, or some of you don't know, that Edward J. Epstein, the man who wrote Inquest, was writing a book on John Kennedy's assassination, and he had an interview with George de Morenschild, a man from the Nazi intelligence, CIA, Defense Intelligence Agency, who was Lee Harvey Oswald's intelligence contact in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. And Edward Epstein, for Reader's Digest, a book published by them, saw de Morenschild in the morning in Florida, and he was to see him again later in the day. And in the lunch hour, George de Morenschild allegedly commit suicide, shot himself through the mouth, and was killed. On one of my early tapes on Nelson Rockefeller, I said it's possible among the about 11 motives for murdering him at this time was, one, the connection of Nelson Rockefeller to George de Morenschild and to Donald Donaldson, both men that were killed, and also to the disappearance of John Paisley at this time, who worked with these particular people, because Nelson Rockefeller's name was directly linked to these particular men who were murdered this year. Well, there were three of them. Paisley's missing. I don't know whether he's dead or just missing. Donaldson and de Morenschild. But I think it's interesting that a man from Reader's Digest was with de Morenschild just prior to the time he died, and that the same person was working for Rockefeller and was with him when he died, and the same person was working with media control at a time that Pochetta Pierce was working with the media. Megan Marshak was working with the Associated Press, and Pochetta Pierce was working with CBS News, and she also was working with NBC TV at a time when the media was being curtailed or suppressed. She was also employed by Reader's Digest at one time. The Digest was suppressing free television for us to have access to, and Reader's Digest also had an author with de Morenschild when he was shot, just the same day that he was shot. And I think the conduit of the White House dirty tricks of Richard Nixon is very much intact. You see, Watergate investigated a few dirty tricks, a little bit of hanky-banky. They didn't go into suppression of evidence, destruction of evidence, the Wallace shooting, the death of Mary Jo Kopechne. And the reason they didn't is that to do any one of those things, or the death of Howard Hughes and the secrecy or chicanery of substituting him for Vance Cooper, the reason they didn't do any one of those things is that they would break the chain of command, and the chain of command was intact, so that by 1980, all teams are still working. E. Howard Hunt can still forge documents and get paid off. They can plant documents, they can blackmail people, photograph them, compromise them, murder, and they still have control of the public officials in the news media whom they've also blackmailed and compromised into silence. There were memos in the Richard Nixon alternatives for suppressing news, and there's a quotation here, shaping the corporation, probably no amount of restructuring will entirely eliminate the tendency to support liberal causes. On the other hand, this administration has an opportunity to establish by legislation or otherwise structures and counterbalances which will restrain this tendency in future years, and which, as a political matter, it will be difficult for other administrations to alter. It is in this direction that we have been proceeding. You see, Richard Nixon is expendable, but the process was set up just like the Richard Nixon Supreme Court was set up, and that's the important thing to remember, that these eyes-only memos are now released, some of them, and you can see how newscasts were taken off and why public broadcasting has become nothing but an entertainment a place that would fold tomorrow if they didn't get the budget for their foundations. Now they have so many employees and scenes and folios and so forth that they can't survive anymore with just public support, so the foundations have a hold on them, and that's the way they call the shots. If you're going to have an alternative media, we'll control it. I also mentioned last week that the Westinghouse bought 3 new FM radio stations, and that's one reason I went off KLRB, is that it's privately owned by a man who has radio stations in Las Vegas and in Arizona, Phoenix, Arizona, friendly with the Howard Hughes empire and that satellite connection. And even though the owner didn't tell me what to say or what not to say, I didn't choose to work for that anymore. I was waiting to see what their move would be towards me having this kind of news, and they didn't stop me from being on the air, but I went off because I realized that the station was opt-out for the money people who would come in order to hold your jobs. You have to keep quiet, and therefore there wouldn't be a political stand anyway if they were put to the test. So it's a privately owned station playing rock music. A lot of the rock people now linked up to organized crime. District Attorney Robert Morgenthau in Manhattan has conceded that they had an informal inquiry into the questions of Rockefeller's death, but they had uncovered nothing that would warrant a formal investigation. If any of you are so inclined, you can make copies of these tapes on Rockefeller and send them to him, and I'll send him the printed sheets that accompany it and tell him why I think Nelson Rockefeller was murdered. Incidentally, the staff members of the apartment, that cooperative apartment, that I call that CIA safe house, on 54th Street, 25 West 54th Street, which is a $100,000 a year apartment. The staff members of the apartment building where Marshak and Pierce have apartments have been told that they will lose their jobs and be prevented from finding further work if they discuss Rockefeller's death publicly, according to members of the co-op apartment. Now, these are people that bought apartments for $100,000 on 54th Street that have been told that they will never gain employment in another place. And see, I believe it is a CIA safe house for entertaining ambassadors and journalists and media people from Rockefeller Center, NBC, ABC, the whole network, you see. And I bet you there are many people in New York City that know very well that apartment on 25 West 54th Street. It was decorated with Rockefeller artifacts and many ambassadors and prominent people. But the district attorney there says that he's had not enough information to warrant a formal investigation, and yet the people in that apartment have been told that they will lose their jobs and will never again find other work if they discuss publicly what went on in that building. Now, it would be hard to stop an employee of a cooperative apartment from getting work unless the intelligence community had a vested interest in keeping quiet how that house was used. People magazine has an article about Megan Marshak, but there are just two sentences that are worth repeating here. This is February 26, 1979. It said she had drive and ambition, could be Megan's middle name. Through bluff or bluster, she always managed to be places she wasn't really credentialed to be. She's a talented lady, but she pushed her way to the top in everything. Now, I don't think you can push your way to the office of the Vice President of the United States just having been in Washington 6 months, or I don't think you can be on the press corps down at San Clemente with Richard Nixon or covering the Sarah Jane Moore story unless the intelligence community put you in that position. It's like Donald Segretti hanging up a hat in a law office and saying he's a lawyer when he's working for the CIA. This woman's drive and ambition is similar to all those White House plumbers that went around doing their dirty work and undermining this government. But she wasn't credentialed. I said that from the very beginning when I asked questions about Megan Marshak. She didn't have the credentials to be where she was, and she had said just before Rockefeller's death that she was ready to move back to California, even though she owned that expensive real estate in New York, and she has been quoted as saying she could retire now. A friend of mine works at Davis, California, and called me. She'd heard me at KGO talking about Megan Marshak, and she attended a party last week. Megan was up there visiting her brother. She skipped out of New York without further questioning by any grand jury, And she wasn't in deep mourning. She was at a party last weekend up at Davis, California. She's left since then, but a friend of mine was at a party where she was, and everybody was having a good time. Dr. Michael Bodden of the CIA, who I've mentioned on other tapes, had an article in the New York Post saying that he urged Happy to allow an autopsy on Rockefeller. Now, that is so wrong. The New York Medical Examiner urged Happy. Happy doesn't have the decision, and I've made that before, of whether or not to have an early cremation or an autopsy. He said the family wanted the body cremated almost immediately, but he delayed this while trying to convince them to have the autopsy to deal with questions that might arise. I don't believe that Happy had the choice because Dr. Esikoff was not treating him for a heart condition. The doctor who was treating him hasn't been identified, and I don't believe he had a heart condition. And they didn't have to let him have a cremation a day early. They could have kept the body around, and there's no indication of examining that body, as I said before, for stomach fluids or the injection of a poison, cyanide, into his body where he would die very quickly. The New York Post says that Dr. Ernest Esikoff viewed the body at Lenox Hospital and certified he died of a massive heart attack, but now Michael Bodden is saying it's possible that other causes of death might have been missed. Can you imagine the discrepancies in this death, and Nelson Rockefeller is taken 22 blocks to a hospital where a specific Dr. Esikoff looks at him and says, yeah, he had a heart attack. Okay, you can have him. You want to cremate him? Go ahead and cremate him. He looked at the body. He viewed the body. And now there's a question of the color of the body. The usual color of a heart attack wasn't there. It was a different color, and there's a discrepancy in the news about the condition of the body because of the color of the body. The paramedics made the statement that his face was not tinged with a bluish discoloration characteristic of heart attack victims, and it was Officer George Frangos, the first policeman to reach him, that said his face was reddish. It wasn't blotched or bluish like a heart attack. And they also made comment that there was wine in his stomach. And yet this Dr. Esikoff, the one from Johannesburg, South Africa, who graduated in 1952 down there, is the recipient of this body. And then this Dr. Esikoff, who just viewed it, he simply walked up and saw it and said, yeah, that's a heart attack, and signed the statement, and there was no autopsy on Nelson Rockefeller. Dr. Michael Bodden said that state law mandates that permission for cremation be given from the medical examiner's office, but such approval can be given over a telephone. Remember, I mentioned last week that they simply picked up a call and said, can we do a cremation? And they said yes, and that Dr. Norman Morris double-checked with Dr. Bodden. I told you Dr. Michael Bodden of the CIA was out in San Diego at the time, and they gave permission over the telephone to go ahead and do the cremation. Esikoff covered, he said, I recommended an autopsy. I went back to Happy, and she was upset, and she firmly didn't wish it. Bodden said a medical examiner cannot demand an autopsy. Only a court may order an autopsy if there's suspicion of criminality, and there was none in this case. There was no suspicion, and therefore they could do it. But considering all the assassinations that have taken place, you'd think that there would have been some suspicion, unless you worked for the CIA like Dr. Michael Bodden. The ambulance driver was very concerned when he left, the paramedic left the hospital at Lenox Hospital, and Dr. Esikoff said to him, don't speak any more on this. The matter's closed. Don't talk to anybody and don't say a word. And he was saying the cover-up began with Megan Marshak giving orders at the place and acting very authoritarian. That's when the first problem began. And then he said the next problem was Dr. Esikoff saying, don't discuss this matter, that this was very serious. And he concluded by saying, when you consider what's happened to this country in the last 10 years, that was the wrong thing to say. Of course, he hadn't added it up. It's been 15 years since the mishandled autopsy of President John Kennedy and the murder of John Kennedy. But this is one more electoral manipulation, a wheel behind the democratic process, which was eliminated in 1960 and always prior to elections. So some very important people get knocked off, and in this case, it was Rockefeller. But the important thing is the California connections, University of Southern California, Poinsettia Pierce, the Reader's Digest connections, NBC, her CBS connections, the fact that she worked for Rockefeller in 68 on a commission and came down and was told Rockefeller had a heart attack, and she walks down, calls 911, and just walks back to her apartment, doesn't even bother to say, is he alive or dead, or to stay with Megan, disappears, hasn't been interviewed. And since our tape last week, we haven't heard any more about Andrew Hoffman or William Keough, who was in the ambulance. Hoffman with a walkie-talkie that sent the body to Dr. Eshakoff at Lenox Hospital. They're still non-persons in the news. Those questions I asked are not answered, and I won't be happy until they are answered. But I think these connections, these missing years of Poinsettia Pierce, should be detailed. That house should be broken open. People should ask what went on. They should have security guards or police and find out who's threatening that they never can find employment if they talk about that building, because that building is the location of hanky-panky that goes into the fact that even your gasoline is going to go on up to $2 and $3 a gallon. Eventually, the blackmail, the price raises, the price fixing, the oil cartels. Those are the places where the decisions for your life are made, in those halls and in those bedrooms, through the blackmail of congressmen and ambassadors. That's where wars are made or won or fought. And we should know what went on in that apartment, who pays for the apartment, who pays these women. Is it our tax money and the CIA? And what in the heck is going on with so much silence about this case? I think it's time to get a little outraged and do a little more work on the subject. Our time is out again. We'll do some more next week. This is Mae Brussel and Carmel. Stay well. Do you see you next week. Thank you.